as you know from lecture today, we have wrapped up mostly the equilibrium chapter. And if you've looked at the syllabus, you know that we're supposed to be beginning the topic of kinetics, both in lecture and in lab. And no, I can't really expect you to absorb all the kinetics all of a sudden when we haven't even had the exam on equilibrium yet. But a lot of the initial discussion that I'm going to have now regarding kinetics is identical to the discussion you've already had where we were talking about equilibrium. Because you might remember I had done two different diagrams where I had compared a reaction coordinate diagram and a reaction progress diagram. And of course, we ended up spending more time with that reaction progress diagram because that's related to equilibrium. But I had developed the idea of the reaction coordinate diagram so we could talk about how reactions happen. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go back and start from that same point again of what a reaction coordinate diagram is. And I'm going to give you a very specific example that, yes, happens to come from organic chemistry. And the only reason is, especially the first reaction, it's a very logical, straightforward reaction, to explain at least. Sure, there's tons of detail behind it, but just saying what happens, it's not so difficult. So it lets us have a chance to relate how a reaction occurs to these reaction coordinate diagrams. Now, as I do this, I am going to be focusing on kinetics now, because that is the chapter we're going to be entering. So, here is that example reaction. Now, as I present this, you as general chemistry students have no way of saying why this reaction occurs, and I'm not going to ask you to explain why. I am going to tell the story just to give you an idea of how all the concepts you have learned could be used to explain a reaction. So I'm going to tell you how it works, but at the end of the day, all we're going to care about is the reaction coordinate diagram related to it. This first reaction involves two molecules, the hydroxide ion, and then a cousin of methane, where one of the hydrogens has been replaced by a halogen instead. So this specific compound has two names to it. The name I prefer you to use is bromomethane, although it is also called methyl bromide, which it and or its cousin methyl iodide came up in the news some time back. Because one or both of these substances are or were being used as fumicides. And the only problem with that is they are pretty toxic substances for humans if you end up having direct contact with them. A bit of a side story, but just a point to make about this reaction. But in small quantities in a lab, not as big a deal. And what happens in this reaction is this. If you imagine that bromine is more electronegative than carbon, then bromine is going to be slightly negative charged. Carbon is going to be slightly positively charged. We've been talking about polarity this quarter. So that could help explain why hydroxide might want to attack that carbon. Now, of course, carbon can't have more than four bonds at the same time. So if hydroxide tries to form a new bond, well, what ends up happening is the carbon-bromine bond breaks in response. I'm sorry, I've lost my screen here. One moment. Ah, too much technology. Okay, so the product we end up getting is this. Now, you might recognize that OH group being connected to a carbon is now an alcohol. And you might remember I've identified a couple of different functional groups where those are groups of atoms that have similar behavior no matter which molecule they end up on. So an alcohol is where you have O and H, where the oxygen is connected to the carbon. There is, of course, just to be correct, there is a bromide ion that is kicked out as well that ends up being a byproduct, you could say. So let me write this molecule in condensed form, CH3OH. And notice what we have, this CH3 group here. The way it's written as a formula, CH3, indicates that those three hydrogens are just on the carbon. And then when you write OH separately after that, that's trying to show that that oxygen is attached to the carbon. And this is the substance methanol, otherwise known as wood alcohol, which, unlike the alcohol in alcoholic beverages, this stuff causes blindness. Not so good stuff to drink. So, what is the point of showing you this reaction? Because it's all about something known as a mechanism, which I'll define the term mechanism in a little while. But what that means is, how does the reaction occur? And in this reaction, hydroxide and bromomethane react simultaneously to form an alcohol. And the focus should be on that word, simultaneously. And you'll understand why soon. Well, in fact, graphical form you'll understand right now, because let's develop a reaction coordinate diagram for this reaction. Now, you have no way of knowing this without doing the calculations, being given some energy. But in this reaction, it turns out that, yes, the reactants are higher in energy than the products. So the reaction does like to occur. Now, coming back to that word simultaneous, the reason I wrote the arrows the way I did is because it specifically means that hydroxide is coming in at the same time that bromide is getting kicked out. So in terms of what the shape of the reaction coordinate diagram itself would look like, it would be like this. It would have a single transition state. Because there is this quiz question that involved a reaction coordinate diagram, let me go ahead and label all these bits of the reaction coordinate diagram. And no, I did not take off points if you did not do it the way I'm doing it, but I want to point out that because the reactants are higher in energy than the products, really you should only draw the arrow pointing down because you're showing the change that occurs. Similarly, with the activation energy, the amount of energy it takes to begin the reaction, that should only be an up arrow in this case. So now let me define again, what is this activation energy? Well, I came up with two examples, and I don't remember this morning at what point I introduced this, but this is as good a point as any. As a line of movie said once, it's plot exposition. It has to go somewhere. So you might have heard of the phrase diamonds are forever. They used to use that on ads. Maybe they still do. I mean, it's a big fat lie, of course, because diamonds, if you just wait long enough, will turn into a little pile of graphite. Because think about the way that they're made. I mean, the poor dinosaurs, you know, that happened. And then all this carbon and all this pressure and heat and time and pressure and heat and time, and you squeezed all this stuff together. But that means you squeezed carbon into a high energy state to just be kind of loose with terminology and such. And so that state wants to relax, but there's not a good mechanism for that. So it happens incredibly slowly. So in yours and many other lifetimes, you don't have to worry about your bling. But eventually it would turn into graphite. But then if you took a balloon full of hydrogen and took a match to it, there's not much of a delay time between what you do and the reaction to that, right? So one of these processes has a very tiny activation energy. One of them has a huge one. And so that activation energy is the energy necessary for a reaction to be successful. And then on the x-axis here, we have reaction coordinate, which I'm going to come back to in a moment. On the y-axis, we have energy, which right now we're talking about enthalpy, delta H. And then at the top of the diagram here is the transition state. Now, let's come back to this concept of the reaction coordinate, because let me tell you what really this is supposed to represent. And imagine this. Imagine that all the atoms in this reaction, I was able to independently move around. And then let's say that moving them anywhere I want to, I then calculate how much energy would this whole system have. And let's say that I threw all the atoms together like that, and I could come up with, starting with the reactants, ending up with the products, come up with what would the most likely pathway of the reaction be. Because you might imagine if atoms start doing their own random thing, there'd be certain combinations that are just wildly impossible. And there's got to be some more likely course of events. Now, let's say that we wanted to create this graph, and it's going to look like mountains and valleys to show our high and energy, low in energy points. But how many dimensions in an example reaction like this up above would we need to describe such a system? And if that was too poetic, let me say it again. Here's a set of atoms. Calculate the amount of energy that system has depending on the position of each atom. How many dimensions are going to be in that graph? Two. Well, that's the graph we're using, yes. But technically, how many should it be?
Three.
Well, three, why? Why would you suggest three?
I think that when you say, you're saying how many elements will be part of that graph, mm-hmm. I'm thinking like you'll have like an x-axis value, a y-axis value, and then the slope will count for something.
Well, but in three-dimensional space, how many coordinates do we use to represent just a single atom?
I have no idea.
Three. Three-dimensional space, three coordinates, x, y, and z. You were on the right track with that. But that's for one atom that moves independently. If you have, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 atoms, then how many coordinates will you need to describe the positions of all 7 atoms together?
21, I guess.
That's right. And then when you plug all 21 atoms into this equation, out's going to pop an answer, which is energy, which is your 22nd coordinate that goes on the graph. So in other words, you need a 22-dimensional graph, which I'm sure all of us are able to visualize.
Probably not.
Well, that's the point. So then what we do is we take the 21 dimensions and we squish them down to one. We say, what is the most likely pathway through the reaction? And that is the reaction coordinate. That's what we're doing. We're playing around with coordinate systems. So the reaction coordinate is a simplification of a multi-dimensional graph. And it represents the most likely, which means the most energetically favorable, pathway through a reaction. Screenshots, everyone. So we're going to be referring back to this reaction over and over again because it's one of my main example reactions. But now I want to show you a relative that starts with the same kind of material, a carbon hooked up to a halogen, and ends up with the same kind of product, an alcohol. But it happens a totally different way. So let's see what this is that I'm talking about. I will write the initial molecule out in expanded format once. Looks like a big, scary molecule. That's written full structure. Now, what does that look like as a line structure? A little bit simpler to draw, right? Remember that on these kinds of diagrams, where there is no label, that's the same thing as saying it's equal to carbon. So, you see that the original molecule has four carbons. That's why there's four missing points on this structure. Now, beyond that, look what's connected to the carbon. We have one explicitly written bond, which is the carbon-carbon bond. But there's only one bond. Written to the circled carbon. Which, not to over-colorize, but let me do that. Show which bond I'm talking about. So only one bond is written to the circled carbon, which automatically means there are three hydrogens attached. Why? Well, because that's the way that the system works. Why? Because that's the way the molecules exist. Carbon, when it's out in the open atmosphere, if it's reacted with something, tends to be connected to hydrogens, unless it also happens to be connected to an oxygen or a nitrogen or something like that. But the default is basically hydrogen. So that's why we do the writing system the way we do. Okay, now, how can we write this in a more simplified molecular structure? So notice that it's got three of these CH3 groups, which the word used happens to be methyl. So in writing the formula, we would do it like this. We could say parentheses CH3, close parentheses 3. Three methyl groups attached to a carbon that is attached to a bromine. Now, let me use the line structure form to say what happens, because not yet trying to explain why the reaction does what it does, let me just say that in this case, it occurs in a very different way. This compound has a bond-breaking event that occurs all on its own. And what that ends up producing is a cation. Now, if you had something floating around in solution like water, water has electrons that could interact with that cation. Now, of course, oxygen would start out neutral in water itself. But if it makes a new bond, then it's no longer neutral because it's got this extra connection. So it would very quickly want to lose a hydrogen again in order to become a neutral alcohol. Now, if you look at the arrows, this last one I wrote might be confusing because you might look at it and say, hey, I thought you said that the hydrogen was leaving. How come you're pointing to the oxygen? So all of these arrows always show where electrons go, and the electrons are falling back to oxygen, which is why hydrogen doesn't have a connection anymore, which is why hydrogen leaves. Okay, so what is the point of this story? Well, let's see if we can write a reaction coordinate diagram for this reaction. Now, this morning, when I tried to describe this, I think I launched into it in a way that may have confused my point. So, what I'm going to tell you is this. The energy changes that are going to happen here are not ones that you'd be able to predict. You'd have to learn the story to understand it. So, and it's complicated because it depends on knowing what we're learning at the end of this quarter. That's why I can't really tell the true story. But here's the simplified version for now. The reactants still end up being higher in energy than the products in this case. But the graph is a great bit more difficult or complicated because there's not just one individual step in the reaction. So first the bond breaks, then the cradle falls. No. First the bond breaks, which normally a bond breaking requires energy. Now, see, that's where things get really, really complicated because there can be circumstances where, yes, it takes energy to break that bond, but then when it's broken, there might be some stabilization that occurs by some outside influence, which complicates the whole story. So, right now, just accept that this first step is really uphill in energy because a bond is breaking. Now then we form a new bond. But we're exchanging one positively charged thing for another positively charged thing. So maybe we lose some energy, but we don't drop down low until that final positive charge is resolved and we end up with a neutral molecule again. Now, as I said, the overall heat of reaction is still negative. This thing still wants to go downhill in energy. But there's not just one transition state anymore. There's three different points where the reaction transitions. And as we're going to find out, the number of transition states is equal to the number of individual steps. For right now, I'll say reaction steps.
Professor, I have a quick question.
Yes, please.
So you can see from this graph that the reaction is largely endothermic, but it ends up being exothermic, right?
You could say that the first step of the reaction is endothermic, but the reaction overall is exothermic.
Okay, so no matter what, even if P drops below R, like the tiniest smidge, it's still exothermic.
Yes, but you're grappling with the whole point of this chapter now, which is, hey, we got this big hill that's right here at the beginning of the reaction. Yeah. So let me come back to that point. Let me come back to that point in just a moment, because that's a good observation. But let's label the graph then. Because that thing that you're talking about is the activation energy. But just like there's three transition states, there's three activation energies. And notice they're not all measured from the initial reactant. Because once you're up in the air, you don't have to add all the energy over again to be up in the air. You just got to add that little extra to get up to the next transition state. Now, I labeled the reactants and products, and let me change the color to make that pop out. Yeah, pretty good. There we go. So there's reactants and products, but what goes in between? Well, now we have intermediates. And what's an intermediate? Exactly what it sounds like. Something that you get during the course of a reaction that may not exist for very long a time at all. But if you devise ingenious enough, dare we say, diabolical reactions that are able to trap these things, then maybe we can detect them to help show that that's how the reaction occurs. That's part of what you do in the study of kinetics, is try to prove that, yes, this is how this thing occurs. But an intermediate, therefore, is not always something that can be isolated. Something just appears at some point during the reaction. So, I should summarize this reaction in words somehow, because I did that for the first reaction. So let me look back. The reaction, in this reaction, an alcohol forms by a process that involves multiple steps. Now, there's a lot more that's going to be coming here. I'm sorry, I keep looking at these movie titles. You know, of course, they're going to get Chris Hemsworth to play me in the movie version. It would only be fitting. Screenshots. So let's get to some of the terminology that's going to let me explain why did I just show you these two different reactions. And this is something known as a mechanism. I used that term earlier, but let me finally get around to defining it. So mechanism is the step-by-step way in which a reaction occurs. The point of bringing up mechanism is exactly what we saw in these two example reactions, that a reaction could be a single step or it could be composed of multiple fundamental steps. A reaction can be composed of one or more fundamental steps. Such as a bond breaking, a bond forming, or an electron transfer. So now, can I flip back, or may I flip back for a moment? We'll let you finish writing that sentence. But what I want to show you is now the point that someone was starting to guess at. Now let's go back just one page and look at this previous reaction that has the complicated reaction coordinate diagram. And you notice on it, there is this one step that is higher in energy total and the highest activation energy of any of the steps in the reaction. And the best parallel that I can think of for something like this would be some kind of amusement ride, which I remember not being very amused by as a kid. But, you know, physics, if you get up to the top of the hill and they design the thing correctly, then you'll make it all the way back down to the bottom of the hill again if you get up to that highest point to start with. So same thing in this chemical reaction. Once you get over that major hurdle, okay, so maybe you'll run into a few other little speed bumps, but they're not going to slow you down compared to that first hurdle. Like those of you that are coming from East Side going over to De Anza, when you're going back home in the afternoon, once you get past 87, then you're set, right? I mean, see, there's always this one place that's the bottleneck. So in other words, this is what is known as the rate limiting step, RLS. So now let me go back to here and get to the point, which is this. In many cases, the rate of an overall reaction depends on only one fundamental step. Which is known as the rate limiting step. Let me highlight that. Oh, what did I do? Nope. He's running with scissors, folks. Hold on. There you go. Oh, that's not Secret Volcano Sanctum. That's Secret Volcano Sanctum Sanctorum. So, rate limiting step, RLS. This step is usually the one with the highest activation energy or the highest energy transition state. And so now we've gotten to the whole point of this initial discussion, that I've said here are different ways reactions can occur, and if you go back and review it to make the same kind of product. Two different ways of creating alcohols. Two real-life ways. Suppose you need to make, to synthesize an alcohol. Well, you want to know which one of these mechanisms was the one occurring, because they end up having effects on structure. There's a lot more detail I'm leaving out, but it matters which way the reaction occurs. So now I've shown you we can come up with these reaction coordinate diagrams that explain how they occur. But then here's the main point. Not all reagents have a direct effect on this rate of reaction. And so this last example, you only have one reagent, the one with the bromine, that participates in that rate-limiting step. And that's going to have a huge effect on how fast the reaction occurs. And what I've done, just to put this in perspective, is exactly backwards from what most textbooks do. Because most textbooks say, math, oh yeah, and here's a chemical reaction. Meaning, here's rate, here's a definition of rate, and let's talk more about what rate is, and let's talk about rates of things, and instantaneous and average rates, and rate this and rate that, and then it gets to the fact that, oh, these are chemical reactions we're talking about, and here's all this theory. Which never satisfied me when I was a student. I always thought it was a bit bass-ackwards. So I like saying, here's atoms reacting because we're in chemistry class. Now let's talk about the math that describes how the molecules behave. So this is a perfect time for a break, after which I am now going to revert to the traditional approach, which is to describe the math behind rate. So as promised, now let's take the more mathematical approach. And first, let's have a discussion of rate from a more traditional perspective. So in other words, let's talk specifically about speed. How would speed be defined? Oh, internet. Distance over time. Okay. And if we wanted to expand that out a bit, I could draw the following. So let's say that we have a graph where we look at distance, versus time. If the shape of my graph looked like this, what kind of statement could we make about the speed that's here? Constant speed, that is right. How do we know that? Well, because we have a linear relationship that's going on. So it doesn't matter where along this graph I do this. I could take two points, create a triangle, and I could talk about the change in y, which would be the change in distance, versus the change in time. And I'd have coordinates that I could call time 1, distance 1, and time 2, distance 2. And so we could say that the speed here would be equal to where we ended versus where we started, divided by when we ended versus when we started. And so, really, to make the speed definition up here, speed over or distance over time, it's really more correct to say total or change in distance divided by the change in time. Now, this is if we have something traveling at constant speed. The story gets a little bit messy if it's not constant. So take your screenshots, because let's talk about the messy for a minute. What if we had a graph? Imagine, if you will, that we had this graph that was distance, again, on the y-axis, time in seconds, on the x-axis, but non-linear. Let's say something like this. We could do the same thing that we did before, which is that we could come up with two points on this graph. We could do the delta y, delta x thing. But, you know, that leaves out some information here. That leaves out the fact that the speed is changing in between these two points. And so this is what we would call the average rate. Which is calculated only on the, get this, initial and final states. But, you know, in cars, we have these things that tell us how fast we're going without having to necessarily measure two places on a road, which maybe that's a poor example. But still, mathematically even, there is a way to come up with what is known as instantaneous speed. Which, as the name sounds, it's the speed at any one point. And mathematically, what is done is you figure out what the slope is at that point. But, you know, the first time you learn about it, it's a kind of a brain-twisting concept. Because let's say that we wanted to find out the instantaneous speed. So that would be equal to the change in distance over the change in time, which if you're a point, that's equal to 0 divided by 0, which is, you know, that's where infinity, I mean, that's where black holes happen, right? So, I apologize for what I'm about to do, sort of. But, you know, there's some of you that are going to get this. And if you do, well, I'll say what that is afterwards. Let's say that we have this function that describes the change in time. And another way we could write this then, because y equals x squared, that's our usual xy thing, but math, you have to make it complicated. So we could say that there is a function that has a value with respect to time that's equal to time squared. Now, given my handwriting, T is a very terrible symbol for me to use. Because if you say T plus, well, did you just say plus plus or TT or T? Or, I mean, what did you just write? So I'm going to fix this whole thing. And I'm going to use a different letter. So let's say that Y is equal to a function of, why not just X? Keep it simple, right? And that's going to be equal to x squared. Now, here's the trick what we do. We say, okay, we'll figure out the speed, and it's equal to what? Well, it's equal to f of x, a little bit ahead of where we are right now, versus what the value of the function is right where we are right now. And, of course, that would be a change in distance. And so the time would be now.
I have a question about this.
Yes.
In the red writing, does that say S under zero?
No, zero divided by zero.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
So what I was saying here is we have, time, but we're going to use X instead, right? So we have X plus delta minus X. And then we pull this trick. It's like, well, what if we make that delta smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller? What are we going to get? Well, this is equal to X plus delta squared, because the function is X squared, minus X squared over X plus delta minus X is just plain old delta, right? So then we simplify further. We get X squared plus 2X delta plus delta squared minus X squared divided by delta, which is the X squareds cancel here, just like the X is canceled up above. So then we get 2x delta plus delta squared divided by delta, which is equal to 2x plus delta, which the way to evaluate that is that if you really let delta be 0, then it just equals 2x. And you just got your first derivative for those of you who haven't had calculus yet. Because this expression here is the slope at an instantaneous point. And it's a really sneaky way of doing it. You say, okay, here's point A, and point B is just a little bit over there. And you make the little bit closer and closer and closer and closer. And in this case, you end up with a value you always can end up with an answer for. And that's instantaneous speed. Okay, now that that happened, no, none of that's going to be on the quiz. No, but you do have to know what an average rate versus an instantaneous rate is. And if some of you accidentally understood what I was talking about here, well, you know, being a little bit ahead for your calculus class, what's so bad about that? Screenshots. Clean cup, move down. All right, so I talked about, in general, what is rate. So now, what is the rate of reaction? Well, it's not distance anymore. How would we define rate? What's changing in a chemical reaction? Hello, internet.
Heat.
Huh?
Heat. Energy.
Temperature.
Maybe temperature, not always. Heat, yes, but entropy?
The amount of products and reactants.
In other words, concentration. Rate is the change in concentration over the change in time. Or, those of you in calculus, rate is the instantaneous change in concentration versus the instantaneous change in time. Us normal people, we'll use this version because this is the average rate. And then chem majors, which are a distinct branch of people, this is the instantaneous rate. Now, if we finally have a definition for what rate is, that very quickly leads us into discussion of this thing called a rate law, which here is your example, and it's what I'll call reaction one. The one I did the very... What's that?
Sorry, Professor. For the instantaneous rate equals delta bracket?
Yeah.
What is it? Okay.
Bracket, concentration.
Thank you.
Professor?
Uh-huh.
Is that delta concentration over delta T, is that supposed to be like partials or yep. just T? Oh, okay.
Partials. Oh, I see what you're saying. Oh. Let me leave it that way. If you know the difference, well, then you know you can argue. But for everybody else, it gets the point across. Wow. Okay, I haven't thought about that in a long time. Anyways, in example one, the first reaction we talked about, they what would the rate law look like? It looks just like this. And I'll explain partly where this rate law comes from in a moment. But let me identify the two things that are in this reaction. There's this thing, K, which is the rate constant, which is really a fudge factor, which those of you that if English is not your primary language, fudge factor is an odd phrase because it sounds like, well, what does chocolate have anything to do with this? When you fudge something, you fake something, you fib something, you falsify something, you make it up, or it's like almost correct, and you or you do something to make it correct. That's what a fudge factor is. It's some kind of proportionality constant to make the units commensurate with one another. See, that just sounds bad, but that's a better definition. What's this other thing in here? Well, we got concentrations. And quite simply, the more the stuff smashes into each other, the more likely a reaction is going to occur. But here's the whole point of me doing that long-winded theory explanation before we did any of the math. Notice that both of the reagents go into this rate law because they are both simultaneously involved in that rate-limiting step. So the rate law generally only contains those substances that participate in the rate limiting step. And then there's a general statement I was making about why reactions occur, which let me slightly expand on that. I say that the rate of reaction depends on the number of successful collisions of molecules involved in the fundamental step. The rate of reaction depends on the number of successful collisions of molecules involved in a fundamental step. Now, this could, in theory, be the rate-limiting step, but technically you can talk about rates of individual reaction steps as well. They may all be faster than the rate-limiting step, but you could still talk about them. So more generally, it's whichever molecules are involved in a step, how many of them collide together, which will then depend on concentration, is related to how fast the reaction is going to go. But if you please take your screenshots, I'd like to now go back and look at the two reactions, the two examples, and summarize them one more time. So here we go. So arbitrarily, just calling this reaction one, because that makes sense. I had said that we have hydroxide, which can react with this bromomethane to cause hydroxide, or a hydroxide will cause bromine to be kicked out. And what we end up with a product as a result is methanol, wood alcohol, and bromide. And as I may have already said before, the rate of this reaction, no, I didn't say this before, slightly different. The rate law for this reaction contains both reagents. Since both reagents are involved simultaneously in the only reaction step. And so I know you already took your screenshots, but I'd like to go back and write in the rate law, which I lost the space for, even though I meant to leave it. Well, here, I'll put it in at the top again. So here we go. Rate is equal to K times bromomethane concentration times hydroxide concentration. And now, if I can flip back after you get that to write it in the summary as well. So what did I just say? That the rate law, of course, has this rate constant, but it's got the two reagents, bromomethane and hydroxide. There is a fancy name for this reaction, and it is bimolecular nucleophilic substitution, which is abbreviated with the symbol SN2. Now, what does the word bimolecular mean? Exactly what's written in the rate law here, that you have two molecules. So I should actually underline the word both. So two molecules involved. At the same time. And that's where the two comes from in the shorthand SN2. Now, there's another reaction I showed you, and to use the abbreviated notation, or, you know, it actually fits so much better if I just use the line notation. So remember, this process, reaction two, oh gosh. So reaction two was this other halogen-containing compound that has a carbon-bromine bond break that makes this cation intermediate that gets attacked by water And that water that just attacked then loses a proton. Remember, last class it was that I defined proton as meaning H+. Now, the point of this reaction is that it's only the first step that really matters in this case, because that is the rate-limiting step. So the rate law for this reaction contains only one reagent, because it is the only one involved in the rate limiting step. And so when we write the rate law for this reaction, it's going to look like this. It's going to be that halogen-containing compound alone in the rate law, along with the rate constant. And this is now called unimolecular nucleophilic substitution. Which I never finished going back and explaining what that means. Obviously, the bimolecular above meant two molecules at one time. And now I'm going to say that unimolecular refers to the fact that there's only one molecule involved. Which is why this is called SN1. One, that is the one molecule that's involved. Now, what does nucleophilic mean? Well, a nucleus is positively charged. So something that's nucleophilic means something that likes positive charge. Well, hydroxide is a negative charge, so obviously that's going to like positive charge. And water, the oxygen, is partially negatively charged. So it makes sense it would be attracted to interact with a partial positive charge. And substitution, that comes from the fact that oxygen is taking the place of bromine one way or another. Now, those of you who are going to end up taking organic chemistry, you'll want to hold on to all of your notes. But still, you'll especially want to hold on to this page of notes, because this topic of what we call SN1 versus SN2, we spend days and weeks on, really, because we don't just do this. We talk about why do the different reactions occur. To just give you a very simple taste, if you look at the summary page, the bottom reaction, the reason hydroxide can't just come in and push the bromine out like above, there's too much stuff in the way. And when you see the fully written structure, it's easier to understand that. There's a whole bunch of atoms around where that bromine's connected to carbon. So that's why no simultaneous reaction's possible in that case. And there's lots of other details to talk about. So that's what we do in organic chemistry. But to justify why did I use this reaction? Because it has these two very clear explainable pathways. So it's a great way to talk about what a rate-limiting step is. Now, if you wanted to get an interesting reaction, if you happen to have any friends that are taking organic chemistry, you could just show them this last page of the notes and say, yeah, this is what I was looking at learning in my 1B class today. And they'll be like, what? Just in case, you know. So that is your introduction to kinetics.